Side 9, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 258. When the father of the gods sweeps into the ruins of the healing chamber on Olympus, surveys the damage, stares at Aphrodite's body lying pale amidst a nest of writhing green worms on the wet floor, and then turns to look in my direction, I am sure that Zeus sees me, that he looks right through whatever cloaking device powers the Hades helmet and sees me. But although he stares directly at me for several seconds and blinks those glacially cold gray eyes of his, as if coming to some decision, he looks away again, and I, Thomas Hockenberry, formerly of Indiana University and more recently of Helen of Troy's bed, am allowed to continue living. My right arm and left leg are badly bruised, but nothing is broken, and still cloaked by the Hades helmet from the sight of these scores of gods rushing into the healing room, I escape the building and QT to the only place I can think of, other than Helen's bedroom, where I can rest and recuperate, the Skolix barracks at the foot of Olympus. Out of old habit, I go to my own cubicle, my own bare bed, but I keep the Hades helmet cowl pulled up and activated as I flop on it and doze fitfully. It has been one hell of a long day, and night, and morning. The invisible man sleeps. I awake to the sound of screams and thunderclaps on the floor below. By the time I rush out to the hallway, the Skolic named Blix runs by, almost runs into me, actually, since I'm invisible to him, and explains breathlessly to another Skolic named Campbell, "The Muse is here and she's killing everybody." It's true. I cower in the corner of a stairway as the Muse, our Muse, the one Aphrodite had called Meliti, strikes down the few fleeing Skolics left alive in the blazing barracks. The goddess is using bolts of pure energy from her hands, corny, cliched, but horribly effective on mere human flesh. Blix is doomed, but there's nothing I can think of to do for him or the others. Nightenhauser. The stolid Skolic has been my one real friend the last years. Panting, I run to his room in the barracks. The marble is scarred, the wood is ablaze, the window glass has melted, but there's no charred corpse here as there are littering the hallways and lounges. None of those burned bodies had looked large enough to be the burly Nightenhauser. Suddenly, there come final screams from the third floor, then silence except for the increasing roar of flames. I look out a window and see the Muse flit by in her chariot, holographic horses in full stride. Near panic, choking audibly on the smoke, if the Muse was still in the barracks, she would hear me now. I force myself to visualize Ilium and the restaurant where I'd last seen Nightenhauser. Then I grasp and twist the QT medallion and escape. He's not at the restaurant where I'd seen him early that morning. I flick to the battlefield. He's not in his usual spot on the ridge above the Trojan lines. I take just enough time to notice that Hector and Paris are leading the Trojan troops in a successful attack against the fleeing Argives, and then I QT to a shady place behind Greek lines, near their moat and line of stakes, where I've bumped into Nightenhauser in the past. He's there, disguised as Dolop, son of Clytius, who has some days left before being killed by Hector, if Homer is right. Not bothering to morph into any shape other than gawky Hockenberry, I pull off the Hades helmet cowl and run to the other Skolic. Hockenberry, what? Nightenhauser is shocked by my unprofessional behavior and by the reaction of other Achaeans nearby. Drawing attention to oneself is the last thing a Skolic wants, except, perhaps, to be burned to cinders by a vengeful Muse. I have no idea why our Muse is wiping out all the Skolics this day, but my guess is that I've somehow caused this slaughter of the innocents. We have to get out of here, I say, shouting over the din of rushing reinforcements, neighing horses and rumbling chariots. It looks from this dusty vantage point that the entire center of the Greek lines has given way. What are you talking about? This is an important day. Hector and Paris are fuck Hector and Paris, I say in English. The Muse has QT'd into solidity, high above the Trojan lines where Nightenhauser and I often station ourselves. Another Muse driving her flying chariot as she leans over the side and scans the troops with her enhanced vision. Morphing will not save us mortal Skolics this day. As if to demonstrate this, the Muse named Meliti, my Muse, raises her palms and fires a coherent beam of energy earthward, striking a Trojan foot soldier named Dias, who should be alive to be bossed around in Book 24, according to Homer, but who dies this day in a flash of flame and a whirlwind of smoke and heat. Other Trojans flinch away, some fleeing back toward the city, not understanding this goddess's wrath on a day of victory ordained by Zeus. But Hector and Paris are a quarter of a mile to the southeast, leading their charge and don't even look back. "That wasn't Dias," gasped Knightenhauser. "It was Houston." "I know," I say, returning my enhanced vision to normal scope. Houston was the youngest and newest of the Skulliks. I'd barely spoken to him. He was probably on the Trojan lines today because I'd gone missing. Mimuse's chariot banks sharply and flies directly toward us. I don't think the bitch Muse has seen us yet. We're standing amidst hundreds of milling men and horses, but she will in a few seconds. What do I do? I can pull the Hades helmet on and run like a coward again, leaving Knightenhauser to die just as I failed Blix and the others. There's no way this single cow can hide us both from the goddess's divine vision. Or we can run toward the black ships. We won't get 20 yards. The chariot drops lower and cloaks itself so that it's hidden from the view of the surging Greeks and Trojans below. With our nano-altered vision, Knightenhauser and I can still see it coming on. "What the hell?" cries Knightenhauser, almost dropping his recording wand as I embrace him, throwing both arms and one leg around him like a skinny foot soldier trying to rape this burly bear of a man. Arm around the big Skolik's neck, I grab the QT medallion and twist. I have no idea if this will work. It shouldn't. The medallion is obviously designed to transport just the person wearing it. But my clothes come with me when I QT, and more than once I've carried something else from place to place through Planck space. So perhaps the quantum field established for teleportation includes things my body is in touch with, or that my arms surround. What the hell indeed, it's worth a try. We pop into existence in darkness, tumble down a hill, and roll apart. I look around wildly, trying to determine where we are. I hadn't had time to visualize a destination properly. I'd simply willed myself elsewhere, and quantum teleported us both somewhere. Where? There's moonlight, so it's just light enough for me to see Knightenhauser staring at me in alarm as if I might jump him again at any second. Ignoring that, I look at the sky, stars, sliver of moon, Milky Way, and then at the land, tall trees, a grassy hillside, a river running by. We're definitely on the Earth, the ancient Earth of Ilium at least, but it doesn't feel like the Peloponnese or Asia Minor. "Where are we?" asks Knightenhauser, getting to his feet and brushing himself off. "What's going on? Why is it night?" "The opposite side of the ancient world, I think," I say. "I think we're in Indiana." "Indiana?" Knightenhauser takes another step away from me. "The Indiana of 1200 plus BC, I say, give or take a century or so." I've hurt my arm and leg again, rolling down the hill. "How do we get here?" Knightenhauser has always been a mellow sort, mildly grumpy in his rambling, rumbling, ursine way, but never really angry about anything. He sounds angry now. "I QT'd us." "What the hell are you talking about, Hockenberry? We were nowhere near the QT portal." I ignore him and sit on a small rock, rubbing my arm. There aren't many hills in Indiana, even in my other life there, but there were hilly, wooded, rocky areas around Bloomington, where Susan and I lived. I believe that in my panic I visualized, well, home. I wish to hell the QT medallion had moved us through time as well as space and plunked us down into late 20th century Indiana. But something about the pure darkness of the night sky and the purely clean smell of the air here tells me otherwise. Who's here in 1200 BC? Indians. It would be ironic if the QT medallion had whisked us away from imminent death by our muse's hand, literally, only to bring us to the new world where we'll be scalped by Indians. Most of the tribes didn't scalp their victims before the white men arrived, drones on the pedantic part of my professor's brain, although I seem to remember reading somewhere that sometimes they took ears as proof of their kill. Well, that makes me feel better. You can always trust a murderer to have a good prose style, so the saying goes, and a professor to come up with something depressing when you're already depressed. "Hockenberry?" demands Knightenhauser, sitting on a nearby footstool-sized rock, not too close to me, I notice, and rubbing his own elbows and knees. I'm thinking, I say in my best Jack Benny voice. Well, when you've finished thinking, says Knightenhauser, maybe you could tell me why the muse just killed young Houston. This sobers me, but I'm not sure how to respond. There are things going on with the gods, I say at last. Plots, intrigues, pacts. Tell me about it, says Knightenhauser, meaning it both in irony and as a serious request. I raise both hands, palm up. Aphrodite was trying to use me to assassinate Athena. Knightenhauser stares. He manages barely not to drop his jaw. I know what you're thinking, I say. Why me? Why use Hockenberry? Why give him the power to QT by himself and the Hades helmet to hide under? And I agree. It doesn't make any sense. I wasn't thinking that, says Knightenhauser. A meteorite slices across the star-filled sky above us. Somewhere in the forest beyond the hill, an owl makes its not-quite-hooting noise. I was just wondering what your first name was. It's my turn to stare. Why? Because the gods discouraged use of first names and we were afraid of getting to know each other well because Skoliks were always being disappeared and replaced by the gods, says the big man, bear-like even in shadow darkness. So I want to know your first name. Thomas, I say after a second. Tom. Yours? Keith, says the man I've known slightly for 4 years. He stands up and looks at the dark woods. Well, what now, Tom? Insects, frogs, and other night critters are making noise in those black woods, unless they're really Indians sneaking up on us. Do you know how to... have you camped a lot? I begin. You mean, will I die if you leave me here alone? Asks Knightenhauser, Keith. Yeah. I don't know, probably, but I suspect my chances are a hell of a lot better here than back on the plains of Ilium. At least while the muse is on the warpath. I guess that Keith is fixated on Indians right now as well. Plus, I have all my little Skolik tech toys and gear. I can make fire, use the levitation harness to fly if I have to, morph into an Indian if necessary, even use the weapon taser. So I guess you should QT back to wherever you have to go and do whatever you have to do, says Knightenhauser. Fill me in later on the details. If there is a later. I nod and stand. It seems strange, wrong, to leave the other Skolik here alone, but I don't see any choice. Can you find your way back? He asks. Here, I mean, to fetch me. I think so. Think so? Think so? Knightenhauser rubs his hand through his wild hair. I hope you weren't the chairman of your department, Hockenberry. I guess the era of first names is over. There's no place in the universe that I'd less rather be than Olympus. When I arrive, the inhabitants of this mountaintop are gathered in the great hall of the gods, making sure that the cowl of the Hades helmet is pulled on tight and that I throw no shadow. I slip into the huge Parthenon-style building. In my 9-plus years as Skolik, I've never seen so many gods in one place. On one side of the long hologram pool sits Zeus, high on his golden throne, larger than I have ever seen him. As I've mentioned, the gods are usually 8 or 9 feet tall, except when they take mortal form, and Zeus usually towers over them by 3 or 4 feet, a divine adult to their cosmic children. But today, Zeus is 25 feet tall or taller, each of his muscled forearms as long as my torso. I fleetingly wonder what this does to that conservation of mass and energy the other Skolik tried to teach me about years ago. But that's not important now. Staying back against the wall away from the milling gods and not making any noise or movement or sneeze that will betray me to all these refined superhero senses, that's important. I thought that I knew all the gods and goddesses by name, but there are scores here that I don't recognize. Those that I do know, the gods and goddesses who have been most involved in the fighting at Troy, stand out in the crowd like movie stars at a meeting of minor politicians. But even the least of these gods is taller, stronger, handsomer, and more perfect than any human movie star I remember from my other life. Nearest Zeus, Opposite him, across the hologram pool, which divides the room like a long moat now, I can see Pallas Athena, the war god Ares, obviously out of his healing tank, which was not damaged when I destroyed Aphrodite's. Zeus's younger brothers, the sea god Poseidon, who rarely comes to Olympus, and Hades, ruler of the dead. Zeus's son Hermes stands near the pool, and the guide and giant killer is as lean and beautiful as statues I've seen of him. Another son of Zeus, Dionysus, the god of ecstatic release, is talking to Hera, and, contrary to his public image, he has no goblet of wine in his hand. For a god of ecstatic release, Dionysus looks pale, feeble, and dour, like a man in only the third week of a 12-step program. Beyond them, looking older than time, is Nereus, the true sea god, the old man of the sea. His fingers and toes are webbed, and there are gills visible below his armpits. The Fates and the Furies are here in force, milling by accident or design between the gods and the goddesses. These are gods, of sorts, yet sometimes they have regulatory power over the other gods. They are not as human in appearance as the regular gods and goddesses, and I confess I know almost nothing about them except that they don't live on Olympus, but on one of the three volcanoes far to the southeast near where the Muses reside. My muse, Melide, is here, standing with her sisters Manimi and Edie. The more modern muses are also in the crowd. The real Calliope, Polymnia, Urania, Arato, Cleus, Euterpe, Melpomene, Terpsichore, and Pelea. Just beyond the muses are the A-list goddesses. Aphrodite is not among them. That is the first thing I notice. If she were, I would be as visible to her as these divinities are to me. But her mother, Dione, is in attendance, speaking to Hera and Hermes and looking very serious indeed. Near that group are Demeter, the goddess of crops, and her daughter Persephone, Hades' wife. Behind them I can see Pisithia, one of the Graces. Farther back, as befits their lesser place, are the Nereids, nude to the waist, lovely and treacherous-looking. The meta-goddess called Night stands alone. Her gown and veil are of a purple so dark as to be black, and even the other gods and goddesses give her a wide berth. I know nothing about Night except rumors that even Zeus is afraid of her, and I've never seen her on Olympus before. I feel like a gawking movie fan in the crowd outside the Academy Awards, trying to separate the superstars from the lesser gods. Hebe there, for instance, standing near the males. She is the goddess of youth, Zeus and Hera's child, but only a servant to the gods. And there, red hair like flames, is Hephaestus, the great artificer, talking to his wife, Charis, who is only one of the Graces. Pecking order among gods and goddesses, I realize, not for the first time, is complicated stuff. Suddenly, the goddess Iris, Zeus's messenger, flies forward. Yes, flies, and claps her hands. "The father will speak," she says, her voice as clear and crisp as a flute solo. Immediately, the scores of soft conversations cease, and the great echoing hall goes silent. Zeus stands. His gold throne and the gold steps leading up to it exude a glow that bathes him in divine light. "Hear me, all you gods and goddesses too," says Zeus, his voice soft but so strong that I feel the vibration of it off the high marble walls. "Some god or goddess this day has tried to hurt Aphrodite, now healing in our hall of healing, and while she will live, it was a close thing, and she will need many more days to heal again. Some god or goddess tried to kill an immortal this day. Tried to kill one of us who is not fated for death." The muttering and shocked conversation start as a buzz and rise to a roar in the huge room. "Silence!" roars Zeus. And this time his voice is so loud that it knocks me down and slides me across the marble floor like a tumbleweed in a tornado. Luckily, I hit none of the gods or goddesses in my slide, and the noise I make is drowned out by the echoes of Zeus's shout. "Hear me now, O gods and goddesses," he continues, his voice amplified as if from the ultimate public address system. "Let no beautiful goddess, nor no god either, attempt to defy my strict decree. You will submit to my will now." This time I am ready for the hurricane force of his voice, and I cling to a column until the energy of it is past.
"Listen to me," says Zeus, almost whispering now, the sense of his power even more terrible for the soft tone.
"Any god who violates my decree by helping the Trojans or Achaeans the way I have seen this month, back that god or goddess comes to Olympus, whipped on by my lightning and scourged by my thunder, eternally disgraced, banned henceforth from Olympus. Defy me, and find what it is like to be cast down to the murk of Tartarus, half a universe away in space and time, in the deepest gulf that yawns beneath our quantum selves." As he speaks, the long hologram pit boils and bubbles, turns pitch black, and then becomes something other than a hologram. The rectangular pit, looking like a dozen Olympic-sized swimming pools laid end-to-end, now broiling and filled with bubbling black oil, suddenly lets loose with a roar of its own and becomes a hole opening on someplace dark and fiery and terribly deep. The stench of sulfur roils up, and the gods and goddesses near the edge back away. "Behold Tartarus," cries Zeus. "The lowest depths of the house of Hades, a place as far below hell as Hades' home is beneath the earth itself. Do you remember you seen your gods and goddesses amongst us when you followed me into that 10-year war with the Titans who ruled before us? Do you remember that I cast Cronos and Rhea, my own parents, beyond these iron gates and brazen thresholds, aye, and Iapetus too, for all his god power?" The hall is silent except for the muted roars and bellows and screams coming up from the open Tartarus pit. I have no doubt whatsoever that this is a hole to hell, not a hologram, falling away not 30 feet from where I cower. "If I cast my parents down into this pit of pits for all eternity," roars Zeus, "do you doubt that I will throw your screaming soul there in a second?" The gods and goddesses do not answer, except to take several paces farther back from that foul void. Zeus smiles terribly. "Come, try me, immortals, so that all can learn." A huge golden cable falls from the roof of the hall, straddling the hole to hell. Gods and goddesses scurry to get out of the way of its fall. It strikes marble with a resounding crash. The rope is thicker than a ship's hawser and seems to be spun of thousands of inch-thick strands of true gold. It must weigh many tons. Zeus strides down his golden stairs and lifts the cable, holding it easily in his giant hands. "Grasp your end," he says almost cheerfully. The gods and goddesses look at each other and do not move. "Grasp your end!" Hundreds of immortals and their immortal servants rush to comply, scrambling for a handhold on the long cable like kids at a picnic tug-of-war. In a minute, there is Zeus alone on his side of the Tartarus pit, casually holding the cable, and the countless mob of gods and goddesses on the other side, powerful god hands gripped tight on gold. "Drag me down," says Zeus. "Drag me down from sky to earth to Hades and deeper, to Tartarus' stinking depths. Drag me down, I say." Not a single god moves a bronzed muscle. "Drag me down, I command thee." Zeus grasps the golden cable and begins to haul on it. Gods' sandals slip and squeak and scuff on marble. Several hundred gods and goddesses all in a row are pulled closer to the pit, some stumbling, some going to their knees. "Pull, goddamn you," howls Zeus. "Pull or be dragged into stinking Tartarus until time itself rots away from the bones of the universe." Zeus tugs again, and 20 yards of gold cable coils behind him. The conga line of gods and goddesses and graces and furies and nereids and nymphs and you name it on the other side, everyone pulling except purple-gowned knight, slides and screeches closer to the pit. Athena is the first on the cable and is only 30 feet from the edge when she screams, "Pull, you gods! Pull the old bastard in!" Ares and Apollo and Hermes and Poseidon and the rest of the most powerful gods put their backs into it. They quit sliding. The cable pulls tighter, fraying and creaking from the tension. The goddesses scream and pull in unison. Hera, Zeus's wife, pulling even harder than the others. The gold cable stretches and groans. Zeus laughs. He is holding them all at check with only one hand on the rope. Now he grabs the cable with his other hand and pulls again. The gods scream like children on a roller coaster. Athena and those near her on the cable go sliding across the marble as if it were ice, closer and closer to the raging Tartarus pit. Even as dozens of lesser immortals surrender and throw themselves away from the cable. But Athena will not release her grip. The gray-eyed goddess is pulled relentlessly to the edge of the steaming trapdoor to hell. It looks as if the whole line of straining, sweating, cursing immortals is going in. Zeus laughs and drops the cable. Score upon score of gods and goddesses fly backward and land unceremoniously on their immortal asses. "You gods and goddesses, children, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, cousins and servants, you cannot drag me down," says Zeus. He walks back to his throne and sits. "Not even if you pulled your arms from their sockets, if you pulled yourselves to death, could you budge me if I do not choose to move. I am Zeus, the highest, mightiest of kings." He raises one huge finger. "But if I choose to drag you up in earnest, I'd hoist you off this Olympus, dangle you in black space above Tartarus, tie on the earth and sea as well, hook the end around the horn of this hill called Olympus, and leave you dangling there in darkness until the sun grows cold." If I hadn't just seen what I have seen, I'd think the old bastard was bluffing. Now I know better. Athena gets to her feet, none more than a yard from the edge of the Tartarus pit, and says, "Our father, son of Cronus, who art in the highest throne of heaven, we know your power, Lord. Who can stand against you? Not us." All the immortals seem to be holding their breath. Athena's temper is legendary, her diplomacy skills frequently lacking. If she says the wrong thing now... "Even so," says Zeus's gray-eyed daughter, "we pity these mortals, my doomed Argive spearmen, acting out their little roles on their little stage, dying their terrible deaths, drowning in their own blood at the end of their little lives." She takes another two steps so that the tips of her sandals are hanging over the edge of the black pit. Somewhere, thousands of feet below her in the lightning-lashed Tartarus darkness, something large bellows in pain and fear. "Yes, Zeus," continues Athena, "we will keep clear of the war as you command. But grant us at the very least permission to offer our mortal favorites tactics that may save them, so that they all won't fall beneath the lightning of your immortal wrath." Zeus looks at his daughter a long moment, and I, for one, can't read his eyes. Fury, humor, impatience. "Tritogenia, third-born child, dear daughter," says Zeus, "your courage has always given me a headache. But do not lose heart, for nothing of the lesson I showed you here today flows from anger, but only seeks to show all gathered here the consequences of their disobedience." And having spoken, Zeus steps down from his throne and his personal chariot flies in between the giant pillars, his pair of bronze-hooved horses, real, I see, not holograms, landing near him, their golden manes streaming behind them. Strapping on his golden armor and lifting his whip from its stand, Zeus climbs aboard his battle car, cracks the lash, and I watch the matched team and chariot roll across marble and then take to the air, circling the hall once 100 feet above the gods and goddesses' heads, before flying out between the pillars and disappearing in a crack of quantum thunder. Slowly the gods and goddesses and lesser sorts file out of the hall, murmuring and plotting among themselves, none, I'm sure, planning to obey their lord and king. And me, I just sit here for a while, invisible and glad to be so. My jaw is hanging slack, and I am breathing shallowly like a whipped dog on a hot day. It feels like I'm drooling slightly. Sometimes, up here on Olympus, it's hard to believe completely in cause and effect and the scientific method. 25. Texas Redwood Forest. Beeman was all alone now, just him and the Sony in the forest clearing, and he didn't like it. After Savi left, Odysseus had told his endless, pointless story and walked into the woods at the end of it. Hannah had waited a minute and then gone after the old man. Beeman had known immediately that morning that Hannah and the bearded man had slept together the night before. His sex radar was seldom wrong. A few minutes later, Ada and the other old man, Harmon, had said they were going for a short walk and then disappeared under the trees in the opposite direction. Beeman knew that they'd had sex the night before as well. Evidently, he and the old witch Savi were the only ones not having any fun. So now Beeman was alone in the forest glade, leaning against the hull of the landed Sony and listening to leaves stirring and branches breaking in the dark woods, and not liking it one bit. If an Allosaurus appeared, he was ready to leap into the Sony, but what then? He didn't even know how to access the holographic controls, much less how to activate the force field bubble or fly away. He'd be an hors d'oeuvre on a plate for the dino. Beeman considered shouting into the woods, calling for Savi or any of the others to return, but immediately thought better of it. Were dinosaurs and other predators attracted to noise? He wasn't going to experiment to find out. Meanwhile, he was acutely uncomfortable, not just from the anxiety, but from the need to go to the toilet. The others may have scampered off into the forest with the tissues Savi had provided, but Beeman was a civilized human being. He'd never gone to the toilet without, well, a toilet, and he wasn't going to start now. Of course, he didn't know how many hours it would be until they got to Artist's Hall. And Savi was talking as if she wasn't even going to stop there, just drop off Hannah, Ada, and the preposterous imposter calling himself Odysseus, and then head on to the Mediterranean Basin, or wherever it was. Beeman knew he couldn't wait that long. He realized that he was discouraged more than frightened. Everyone had seemed surprised yesterday when he volunteered to go with the old woman and Harmon on their preposterous expedition. But no one had guessed his real reason for choosing that alternative. First of all, he was afraid of the dinosaurs around Artist's Hall. He wasn't going back there. Second, all that talk of faxing being a sort of destruction and rebuilding of people had made him extremely nervous. Well, who wouldn't be, so shortly after waking up in the infirmary and knowing that your real body had been destroyed? Beeman had faxed almost every day of his life. But the thought of stepping into a fax portal now, knowing that it was going to break down his muscles, bones, brain, and memory, and then just build a copy somewhere else, if the old woman was telling the truth, well, that idea bothered the hell out of him. So he'd opted for traveling on the Sony for a few more days, facing neither artists, dinosaurs, nor fax destruction of his atoms, or molecules, or whatever. Now he just wanted a toilet and a servitor, or his mother to make him supper. Perhaps he would demand that the old woman drop him off at Paris Crater after Artis. It wasn't that far away, was it? Even though he'd got a glimpse of Harmon's scribbles, his map, Beeman had no concept of the world's geography. Everything was as precisely as far away as everything else, a fax portal step. The old woman stepped out of the forest, saw Beeman alone leaning against the floating Sony, and said, "Where is everyone?" "That's what I was wondering. First the barbarian left, then Hannah went after him, then Ada and Harmon walked off that way." He gestured toward the tall trees on the opposite side of the glade. "Why don't you use your palm?" said Savi, and smiled as if something she'd said amused her. "I already tried," said Beeman, "on your ice thingy, at the bridge. Here, it doesn't work." He raised his left palm, thought of the finder function, and showed her the blank rectangle of white floating there. "That's just the immediate locator function," said Savi. Just an arrow guide once you're close to something, like inside a library hunting for a volume but in the wrong aisle. Use Farnet or Proxnet. Demon stared at her. From his first glimpse of the old woman, he had doubted her sanity. Ah, that's right, said Savi, still smiling that unamused smile. You've all forgotten the functions, generation after generation. What are you talking about, said Demon. The old functions like reading don't work anymore. They went away when the post-humans left. He pointed to the rings crossing in the patch of blue sky above. Nonsense, said Savi. She walked over, leaned against the Sony next to him, and gripped his left arm, turning it palm toward her. Think three red circles with blue squares in the center of each. What? You heard me. She continued to hold his wrist. Idiocy, thought Demon, but he visualized three red circles with blue squares floating in the center of each. Instead of the small rectangle of white-yellow light that the finder function generated, a large blue oval of light now floated 6 inches above his palm. Whoa! Cried Demon, pulling his wrist from her grasp and flicking his hand wildly as if a huge insect had just landed in it. The blue oval flickered with it. Relax, said Savi, it's blank. Just visualize someone. Who? Demon actively did not like this sensation, his body doing something he did not know it could do. Anyone, someone close to you. Demon closed his eyes and visualized his mother's face. When he opened his eyes again, the blue oval was busy with diagrams. Street grids, a river, words that he could not read, an aerial view of the black circle that could only be the crater in the heart of Paris Crater. The image zoomed, and suddenly he was in a stylized structure. Fifth floor, back domi near the crater, not his home. Two stylized human figures, cartoon characters, but with real human faces were in bed, the female above the male, moving. Demon closed his hand into a fist, shutting off the oval. Sorry, said Savi, I forgot that no one's using trace inhibitors these days. Your girlfriend? My mother, said Demon, tasting bile. It had been Goman's Domi complex across the crater. He knew the layout of the rooms from when he was a boy, playing in the inner rooms while his mother consorted with the tall, dark-skinned man with the wine-smooth voice. Demon didn't like Goman, and hadn't known his mother was still seeing him. According to what Harmon had said earlier, it was already night in Paris Crater.
Let's try to see where Hanna and Ada and the others are, said Savi.
She chuckled, although they may wish they'd activated Farnet inhibitors as well. Demon didn't want to uncurl his fist. Recycle it, said Savi. How? How do you get rid of your arrow finder? I just think off, said Demon, mentally adding, stupid. Do it. Demon thought. The blue oval winked off. You activate Proxnet by thinking one yellow circle with a green triangle in it, said Savi. She looked at her own palm, and a bright yellow rectangle appeared above it. Demon did the same. Think of Hanna, said Savi. He did so. Both of their palms showed a continent, North America, but Demon could not identify it. Then a zoom to the south-central section, zoom north of the coastline, zoom to a complex series of unreadable words and topographic maps, zoom below stylized trees to a stylized female form with Hannah's head on the cartoon body walking alone. No, not alone, Demon realized, for there was a question mark walking next to her. Savi chuckled again. Proxnet doesn't know how to process Odysseus. I don't see Odysseus, said Demon. Savi reached into his yellow holographic cube and touched the question mark. She pointed to two red figures at the edge of the cloud. That's us, she said. Ada and Harmon must be off the grid to the north. How do we know it's Hanna? Asked Demon, although he'd glimpsed the top of her head. Think close up, said Savi. She showed him her palm cloud, which had zoomed lower, leveled out and was watching the stylized Hanna with the real Hanna's face walk between stylized trees along a stylized stream. He thought close up and marveled at the clarity of the image. He could see the tree shadows on her features. She was speaking animatedly to the symbol. Savi had called it a question mark floating next to her. Demon was glad that he hadn't found Hanna in the middle of sex. Savi must have visualized Ada and Harmon, for her yellow palm cloud shifted and showed two figures walking on topographic symbols somewhere north of the stationary red dots that she'd said were Savi and Demon. "Everybody's alive, nobody eaten by dinosaurs," said Savi. "But I wish to hell they'd get back so we could leave. It's getting late. If this were the old days, I'd just call them on their palms and tell them to get their butts back here." "You can use this to communicate?" said Demon, holding up his bare palm. "Of course." "Why don't we know that?" His voice came out sounding almost angry. Savi shrugged. "You don't know much of anything anymore, you so-called old-style humans." "What do you mean, so-called old-style?" demanded Demon. He was angry now. "Do you really think the Lost Age humans, the old styles, had all this genetically tweaked nanomachinery in their cells and bodies?" asked Savi. "Yes," said Demon, although he realized that he knew absolutely nothing about the Lost Age old styles and cared less. Savi said nothing for a minute. She looked tired to Demon's eye, but perhaps all ancient, pre-firmary humans looked this bad, he didn't know. "We should go fetch them," she said at last. "I'll take Hannah and Odysseus, you get Ada and Harmon. Set your palm on Proxnet, activate your finder the usual way, and that'll lead you to them. Tell them that the bus is leaving." Demon had no idea what bus meant, but that wasn't important. "Are there other functions?" he asked before she could walk off. "Hundreds," said Savi. "Show me one," challenged Demon. He didn't believe her. Not hundreds, but even one or two more would make him popular at parties of interest to young women. Savi sighed and leaned back against the Sony. A wind had come up and stirred the sequoia branches far above them. "I can show you the function that finally drove the post-humans off the Earth," she said softly. "The AllNet." Demon closed his fist again and pulled his hand away. "Not if it's dangerous." "It's not," said Savi. "Not to us. Here, I'll go first." She lowered his arm, pulled his fingers open, and touched his palm in a way he found almost exciting. Then she set her own left palm next to his. "Visualize four blue rectangles above three red circles, above four green triangles," she said softly. Demon frowned. That was difficult. The shapes skittered right at the edge of his ability to hold the image. But he managed at last, his eyes closed. "Open your eyes," said Savi. He did so, wildly grabbing the Sony for support with both hands a second later. There was no palm cloud, no unreadable maps or cartoon figures. Instead, everything within his sight had been transformed. The nearby trees he had been ignoring except to borrow their shade were now towering complexities. Transparent, layer upon layer of pulsing living tissue, dead bark, vesicles, veins, dead inner material showing structural vectors and rings with columns of flowing data, the moving green and red of life, needles, xylem, phloem, water, sugar, energy, sunlight. He knew that if he could read the flowing data, he would understand exactly the hydrology of the living miracle that was that tree, know exactly how many foot-pounds of pressure it was taking to osmotically raise all that water from the roots. Demon could look down and see the roots under the soil, see the energy exchange of water from the soil into those roots, and the long voyage, hundreds of feet from roots to the vertical tubules raising that water, hundreds of feet vertically, like a giant sucking from a straw. And then the lateral motion of the water, molecules of water in pipelines, only molecules wide, out along branches 50, 60, 70 feet wide, narrowing, narrowing, life and nutrients in that water, energy from the sun. Demon looked up and saw sunlight for the discrete rain of energy it was, sunlight striking pine needles and being absorbed, sunlight striking the humus beneath his feet and warming the bacteria there. He could count the busy bacteria. The world around him was a torrent of information, a tidal wave of data, a million microecologies interacting all at once, energy to energy. Even death was part of the complex dance of water, light, energy, life, recycling, growth, sex, and hunger flowing all around him. Demon could see a dead mouse almost buried in the humus on the opposite side of the glade, little more than hair and bones now, but still a beacon of red light energy as the bacteria feasted, and the fly eggs incubated into maggots in the afternoon sunlight, and the slow unraveling of complex protein molecules continued on the molecular level, and gasping, almost gagging, Demon whirled away, trying to shut off this vision, but everywhere was the complexity. The tagged and streaming ebb and flow of energy being passed, nutrients being absorbed, cells being fed, molecules dancing in the transparent trees, and breathing soil and sky ablaze with its rain and surge of sunlight and radio messages from the stars. Demon clasped his hands over his eyes, but too late. He'd looked at Savi, the old woman, but also a galaxy of life. Life nested in the flashing neurons of her brain behind that grinning skull, and firing like lightning on the string of shocks along her retinal nerve, and in the billions upon billions of living forms in her gut, busy and indifferent all, and trying to look away, Demon made the mistake of looking down at himself, into himself, past himself, at his connection to the air and ground and sky. "Off," said Savi. Demon's mind echoed the command. The brilliant midday sunlight bouncing off the trees and needle-strewn soil suddenly seemed as dark as midnight to Demon. His legs ceased to work. Gasping, Demon slid along the edge of the Sony and collapsed on the ground, rolling onto his stomach, arms extended, palms pushed flat, face pressed against pine needles. Savi crouched next to him and patted his shoulder. "It'll go away in a minute," she said softly. "You rest here. I'll go find the others." Ada had been hesitant to go when Harmon suggested they take a walk. She was afraid that Savi would be angry or alarmed at everyone's absence when she returned to the glade. But Hannah had already run off in search of Odysseus, and Ada didn't want to stay there by the Sony alone with Demon. Besides, she didn't know if she'd have another chance to speak in private with her new lover before she returned to Ardis, and he went flying off to the Mediter what's-his-basin with Savi. They walked up a hill, then followed a stream down the other side. The forest was alive with birdsong, but they saw no animals larger than a squirrel. Harmon seemed preoccupied, lost in thought, and the only time he touched Ada was when he extended his hand to help her across the stream, just above a 10-foot waterfall. She wondered if their night together had been a mistake, a miscalculation on her part, but when they stopped to rest at the base of the waterfall, she saw his eyes focus on her, saw the affection and tenderness in his gaze, and was glad they'd become lovers. "Ada," he said, "do you know your father?" She had to blink at this. The question was not quite shocking. People knew they had fathers, of course, theoretically, but such a thing was rarely asked. "Do you mean know who he was?" she asked. Harmon shook his head. "I mean know him. Have you met him?" "No," she said. "My mother told me his name at one point, but I believe he reached his 520 some years ago." She had almost said ascended to the rings, the most common euphemism for passing on bodily into the heaven of the post-humans. Her heart pounded when she wondered why Harmon was asking her this odd question. Did he think there was a chance that he had been her father? It happened, of course. Young women made love with older men who could be their anonymous sperm fathers. There was no taboo on incest, since there was no chance that a child could be born from such a union. And there were no brothers or sisters, since every woman could reproduce only once. But it was strangely disturbing to think about it. "I didn't know who my father was," said Harmon. Savi said that at one point in time, even after the lost age, fathers were almost as important to children as mothers are now. "That's hard to imagine," said Ada, still confused. What was he trying to tell her? That he was too old for her? That was nonsense. "If I'm ever a father," said Harmon, "I want the child to know me. I want to be with the child as he or she grows up, just as a mother would." Ada was too shocked to speak. He began walking again, and she followed him in under the trees. It was cooler in the shade, but the air was thicker there. The waterfall made a soft noise behind them. Suddenly, Ada looked around, alarmed. "Did you hear something?" asked Harmon, stopping next to her. "No, it's just Something's wrong. No servitors, said Harmon. No Voynix. That was it, realized Ada. They were alone. For the last 2 days, the absence of omnipresent servitors and Voynix had been like a missing background noise. But it was more apparent now that they were alone, just the two of them. Suddenly, for no apparent reason, she shivered. Can you find the way back to the Sony? Harmon nodded. I've been making notes on the terrain and watching the sun. He pointed with the branch he was using as a walking stick. The glade is just over that hill. Ada smiled, but she wasn't totally convinced. She checked her palm finder, but it was as blank as it had been since they'd left the Antarctic dummy. She'd been in the woods before, usually on her Ardis estate, but never without a servitor floating nearby to show the way home, or without a Voynix for protection. But this was just background tension to the central anxiety about Harmon's odd question and comment. Why are you talking about fathers? She asked. He looked at her as they strolled farther down the hill, deeper into the sequoia forest. The shade was almost gloomy here, although shafts of light slanted down here and there through the cathedral hush. Something Savi said to me this morning, he said. Something about me being old enough to be your grandfather. About me going after this quest to find the Fermari and getting involved with you as a sort of denial of my final 20. Ada's first response was anger, followed immediately by a stab of jealousy. The anger was at Savi's stupid remark. It was none of the old woman's business who Ada slept with or how old he was. The jealousy came from the fact that Harmon had left their bed that morning at sunrise to go down and talk to Savi. Ada had simply kissed him goodbye when he'd slipped out of bed,
sonicked and dressed that morning,
feeling some disappointment that her new lover did not want to spend another hour with her before they all had to rise for breakfast, but respecting his choice, imagining that he was just an early riser from old habit. But what was so important that he had to leave her at dawn to go talk to Savi? Wasn't he planning to spend the next several days with Savi in his stupid quest for a spaceship? In fact, realized Ada, Savi was taking her place in that quest. She studied Harmon's face, so much younger looking than Odysseus' shocking crow's feet and gray hair, and saw that he hadn't noticed her flash of anger and jealousy. Harmon was still preoccupied, obviously mulling over his own thoughts, and Ada wondered if his attention and sensitivity to her the last few days, culminating in their wonderful lovemaking last night, were aberrations, just part of a prelude to sex, and not his usual demeanor. She didn't think so, but she didn't know. Was all this closeness she'd been feeling with Harmon an illusion, something she'd generated out of her infatuation with him? "Do you know how you choose to get pregnant?" asked Harmon, still poking the ground distractedly with his walking stick. Ada stopped in shock. That question was astounding. Harmon stopped and looked at her as if he had said nothing unusual. "I mean, do you know how the mechanism works?" he said, still seemingly oblivious to how inappropriate his question was. Men and women simply did not discuss such things. "If you're going to lecture me on the birds and the bees," Ada said stiffly, "it's a bit late." Harmon laughed easily. Over the past couple of weeks, that laugh had enchanted Ada. Now it irritated the hell out of her. "I don't mean the sex, my dear," he said. Ada noticed that it was the first time he'd used an endearment with her, but she was in no mood to appreciate it. "I mean when you receive permission to get pregnant, perhaps decades from now, and choose the sperm donor." Ada was blushing, and the fact that she couldn't stop blushing made her angry. She blushed more deeply. "I don't know what you're talking about." She did, of course. It was men who weren't supposed to know or discuss such things. Most women decided to apply for pregnancy around their third 20. Usually, the waiting period was 1 to 2 years before permission was granted, relayed from the post-humans through servitors. At that point, the woman would cease sexual intercourse, take the prescribed pregnancy uninhibitor, and decide which of her former mates would be the sperm father of her child. Pregnancy ensued within days, and the rest was as ancient as, well, humankind. I'm talking about the mechanism by which you decide which stored sperm packet is chosen by your body, continued Harmon. The real old-style human females didn't have that choice. Nonsense, snapped Ada. We are the old styles. It's always been this way. Harmon shook his head slowly, almost sadly. No, he said. Even in Savi's day, just 1,400 years ago, pregnancy was more of a slapdash thing. She says that this sperm storage and selection mechanism was something the posts built into us, into women, based on some borrowed genetic structure from moths. Moths, said Ada, no longer simply shocked, but truly deeply angry now. This was as absurd as it was demeaning. What the hell are you talking about, Harmon His head snapped up, and he seemed to notice her reaction for the first time, as if her retreat to the formal honorific had been a slap in the face, bringing him back to reality. It's true, he said. I'm sorry if I upset you, but Savi says that the posts genetically structured this ability to choose father sperm years after intercourse from the genes of a moth species named... Enough! Shouted Ada. Her hands were balled into fists. She'd never struck anyone in her life or wanted to, but at this moment she was close to swinging at Harmon. Savi says this, Savi says that. I've had enough of that old bitch. I don't even believe she is that old or wise. She's just crazy. I'm going back to the Sony. She walked off into the woods. Ada, called Harmon. She ignored him, walking uphill, slipping on needles and wet humus. Ada! She strode on, ready to leave him behind. Ada, that's the wrong direction. Hannah had caught up with Odysseus a few hundred yards from the glade. He whirled and put his hand on the hilt of his sword when he heard her crashing through the brush, but relaxed when he saw who it was. What do you want, girl? I want to see your sword, said Hannah, brushing her dark hair back from her face. Odysseus laughed. Why not? He unclipped the leather sheath from his belt and handed over the weapon. Be careful with the edges, girl. I could shave with this blade if I ever chose to shave. Hannah drew the short sword and hefted it tentatively. Savi tells me that you work with metals, said Odysseus. He bent to a stream, cupped his hand, sipped. She says that you may be the only person, male or female, in all this brave new world who knows how to forge bronze. Hannah shrugged. My mother remembered old tales about forging metal. She played with fire and open hearths when she was young. She swung the sword overhand, chopping down. You've seen us fight in your turn cloth, said Odysseus. Hannah nodded. So? You're using the sword properly, girl. Hacking rather than stabbing. This tool is made for severing limbs and spilling guts. Nothing more refined. Hannah grimaced and handed the weapon back. Is this the sword you used on the plains of Ilium? She asked softly. And in your adventure to steal the Palladium? No. He lifted the blade vertically until some of the light spilling down between the high branches danced on its surface. This particular sword was a gift to me from Athena during my travels. Hannah waited for more explanation, but instead of telling another story, Odysseus said, Would you like to see what makes this sword different? Hannah nodded. Odysseus used his thumb to tap at the hilt guard twice, and suddenly the sword seemed to shimmer slightly. Hannah leaned closer. Yes, there was a subtle but persistent hum coming from the blade. She lifted one hand toward the metal, but Odysseus' hand shot out quickly, grabbing her wrist. If you touched it now, girl, you'd lose all your fingers. Why? She didn't struggle to pull her wrist away, and after a few seconds, Odysseus released it. It's vibrating, said Odysseus, holding the sword blade flat just below eye level. Hannah noticed again that she was exactly the same height as Odysseus. The night before, she had heard him in the green bubble hall on the bridge after the others had turned in, joined him for a walk, returned to his dome to talk for hours, and had gone to sleep on the floor next to his cot. Hannah knew that Ada thought they'd become lovers. She didn't mind and couldn't think of a reason to disabuse her friend of the notion. It's almost as if it's singing, said Hannah, turning slightly better to hear the high-pitched hum. Odysseus laughed loudly at this, although Hannah didn't know why, Don't worry, he said. It wasn't tossed to me by some lady of the lake, although that's not too far from the truth of it. He laughed again. Hannah looked at the bearded man. She had no clue as to what he was talking about. She wondered if he did. Why does it vibrate? She asked. Stand back, said the barrel-chested man. Most of the sequoia around them were 6 to 10 feet thick. Some thicker, but a smaller pine, perhaps a ponderosa or Douglas fir, was growing in a sunny patch a few yards to their left. The tree was probably 30 or 40 years old, about 50 feet tall, with a trunk perhaps 18 inches thick. Odysseus planted his feet, gripped the sword in one hand, and swung idly at the trunk in an effortless backhand stroke. The blade moved so smoothly through its arc that it appeared that he'd missed completely. There was no noise of impact. A few seconds later, the tall pine tree shivered, shifted, and fell noisily to the ground. Odysseus thumbed the hilt again, and the faint vibration hum ceased. Hannah stepped closer to inspect the chest-high stump and the fallen tree. The trunk sections looked as if they had been surgically separated, not sawed. She laid her palm on the top of the severed stump. There was no sap, no shavings. The wood was so smooth, it felt as if it had been sealed in plastic, cauterized somehow. She turned back to Odysseus. That must have come in handy during the siege of Troy, she said. You weren't listening, girl, said Odysseus. He slipped the weapon back in its sheath and strung it to his broad belt. This was a gift some years after I'd left the war and begun my travels. If I'd had this at Ilium, Odysseus grinned horribly, there wouldn't be a Trojan god or goddess left with a head on his or her shoulders, girl. I promise you that. Hannah found herself grinning back at the old man. They weren't lovers, not yet, but Hannah was planning to stay at Ardis Hall while Odysseus was visiting there, and who knew what might happen. There you are, said Savi, striding down the slope toward them. She closed her fist, and what looked like a palm finder field blinked out. Time to go on? Asked Odysseus, speaking to Savi, but glancing toward Hannah as if they were old conspirators. Time to go on, said Savi. 26. Between Ias Chasma and Copratis Chasma in east-central Valles Marineris. 3 weeks into the voyage west up the river, inland sea, really, of Valles Marineris, and Monmouth was close to losing his Moravec mind. Their Falucca, crewed by 40 little green men, was just one of many ships plying their way east or west in the flooded Rift Valley, or north-south, up or down the estuary, opening onto the Chrysi Planitia Sea of the northern Tethys Ocean. In addition to a score of other LGM crewed Faluccas, they had passed at least 3 100-meter-long barges each day, each hauling 4 great, uncarved stones for heads, all headed east from the cliff quarry on the south side of Noctis Labyrinthus at the west end of Valles Marineris, still some 2,800 kilometers ahead of Monmouth's westbound Falucca. Morpho of Io had been rolled aboard and secured on the lower mid-deck, hidden from aerial view by a raised tarp tied down next to the major pieces of cargo and other items recovered from the Dark Lady. Even the thought of his submersible, left behind in the shallow sea cavern along the Chrysi Planitia coastline, some 1,500 kilometers behind them, depressed Monmouth. Until this voyage, Monmouth hadn't known that he was capable of depression, capable of feeling such a terrible emotional malaise and sense of hopelessness that could leave him with almost no will and even less ambition. But the violent separation from his sub had shown him just how low he could feel. Orfu, blinded, crippled, hauled aboard like so much useless ballast, seemed in good spirits, although Monmouth was learning how carefully and rarely his friend showed his true feelings. The Falucca had arrived, as promised, early that next Martian morning after their arrival on the coast, and while the LGM were man-hauling poor Orfu aboard, Monmouth had gone down into the flooded sub several times, pulling out all the removable power units, solar cells, communication equipment, log disks, and all the navigation gear that he could haul. You swam naked out to the wreck and stuffed your pockets with biscuits before swimming back, eh? Orfu had said that morning after Monmouth told him about the salvage efforts. What? Monmouth wondered if the battered Ionian had finally lost his mind. Little continuity error in Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, rumbled Orfu. I always enjoy continuity errors. I never read it, Monmouth said. He was in no mood for banter. Leaving the Dark Lady behind was tearing him apart. They discussed his reaction during the first 3 weeks of their voyage, since they had little to do aboard the Falaka except discuss things. The short-range radio receiver transmitter that Monmouth had grafted onto Orfu's comline jack worked well.
You're suffering from agoraphobia as much as from depression, said Orfu.
How so? You were designed, programmed, and trained to be part of a sub, hidden under European ice, surrounded by darkness and crushing depths, comfortable in your tight spaces, said the Ionian. Even your short forays on the ice surface of Europa didn't prepare you for these vast vistas, distant horizons, and blue skies. The sky's not blue right now, was all that Monmouth said in response. It was early morning, and like most mornings, Valles Marineris was filled with low clouds and thick fog. The LGM had furled the Falucca's sails and were moving ahead by oars alone. 30 of the little green men rowed, 15 on a side, seemingly indefatigable, whenever the wind didn't move the two-masted, lateen-rigged sailing ship. Lanterns glowed on the bow, forward mast, both sides and stern, and the Falucca was barely moving. This section of the Valles Marineris was more than 120 kilometers wide, and the section they would soon be entering would be 200 kilometers across. An inland sea rather than a river, where, even on clear days, the high cliffs of the north or south banks of the waterway would be invisible in the distance. But there was enough LGM ship traffic along these channels to justify such caution in the fog. Monmouth realized that Orfu was right, that agoraphobia was part of his problem, since he felt the depression most acutely on the clear days where the views were unlimited. But he also knew that it was more complicated than being separated from the secure crash and sensory jacks of his ship. Monmouth had always been a sea captain, and he knew from his own history, programming, and later reading that nothing hurt captains more than the loss of their ships. On top of that, he'd been tasked with an important mission, delivering Koros III to the oceanward base of Olympus Mons, and he had failed miserably. Koros III was dead, as was Repo, the Moravec, who should be waiting in orbit to receive, interpret, and relay Koros's important reconnaissance data. To whom? How? When? Monmouth didn't have a clue. They talked about that as well during their weeks of quiet voyaging. It was even quieter at night since the LGM went into hibernations as soon as the sun set, securing the Falucca with a complicated sea anchor. Monmouth had done echo soundings and determined that the water under them was more than 6 kilometers deep, and not stirring again until sunlight touched their green, transparent skin the next morning. It seemed obvious that the LGM gained energy solely through sunlight, even from the diffused light through morning fog. Certainly, Monmouth had never seen any of the little green men eat or secrete anything. He could ask them, but even though Orfu hypothesized that the individual LGM did not really die after communication, that the little green men were an aggregate consciousness rather than an assembly of real individuals, Monmouth did not trust the hypothesis enough to reach into another little green person's chest, grip what could be his heart, and ask questions that might be deferred until another day. But Monmouth had no reservations about asking Orfu questions. Why did they send us, he asked on their 10th day. We don't understand the mission and aren't suited to carry it out even if we did know what we're supposed to do. It was madness to send us here this ignorant.
Moravec administrators are used to compartmentalizing duties and assigning specialties, said Orfu. You were the best they could find to drive Koros III to the volcano. I was the best Moravec they could get to service the spacecraft. They never considered the possibility that you and I would be the team left to do the work of the other two. Why not? Said Monmouth. They must have known that the mission would be dangerous.
Orfu rumbled softly. Probably they thought that it was all or nothing. That we'd all die if worse came to worst.
We almost did, muttered Monmouth. We probably will.
Describe the day, said Orfu. Has the fog lifted yet?
The days and the scenery and the nights were beautiful. Monmouth's knowledge of breathable atmosphere worlds came exclusively from his databank records of Earth, and this terraformed Mars was an interesting variation. The skies varied from a bright light blue at midday to a pink-red sky at sunset, but sometimes shifted hues toward a pure gold light that infused everything with radiance. The sun itself looked significantly smaller than the sun seen from Earth in old video records, but it was immensely larger and brighter and warmer than any sun known by Galilean Moravex in the last 2,000 years. The breeze was soft and smelled of salt, sea, and sometimes, shockingly, of vegetation.
Do you ever wonder why they gave us that scent? Orfu had asked when Monmouth described the vegetation scent as they entered the broad Valles Marineris estuary from the Tethys.
What's that? Said Monmouth.
Smell.
The European Moravec had to think about that. He'd always taken his sense of smell for granted, although it was useless underwater or on the surface of Europa, and all but useless in the Dark Lady's environmental crash. In other words, everywhere he'd existed. I could smell toxic fumes in the sub, or in the pressurized cubbies of Connemara Chaos Central, he said at last, knowing that this wasn't a satisfactory answer. Moravec's had better built-in alarms for such dangers.
Orfu rumbled softly, I might have smelled the sulfur when I was on Io's surface, but who would want to?
You can smell things, said Monmouth. That doesn't make much sense for a hardvac, Moravec.
Indeed, said Orfu. Nor does the fact that I spent a majority of my time viewing things on the human's visible light spectrum. But I did whenever possible.
Monmouth thought about this as well. It was true, he did the same, even though he could easily see deep into the infrared and UV reaches of the spectrum. Orfu's vision, Monmouth knew, incorporated visualizations of radio frequencies and magnetic field lines, neither common to old-style humans, which made a lot more sense for a Moravec working in the hard radiation fields of Galilean space. So why did the Ionian choose the limited human visible wavelengths most frequently?
I think it's because our designers and all the subsequent generations of Moravex secretly wanted to be human, said Orfu, answering Monmouth's unstated question with no accompanying rumble of irony or amusement. The Pinocchio effect, as it were.
Monmouth didn't agree with that, but he felt too depressed to argue the point.
What do you smell now? Asked Orfu.
Rotting vegetation, said Monmouth, as the Felucca took the far southern channel into the broad estuary. It smells like Shakespeare's Thames at low tide. On the first week of sailing upriver, to keep from going mad from the inactivity, Monmouth disassembled and inspected as best he could the three other pieces of recovered cargo, Orfu being the fourth. The smallest artifact, a smooth ovoid, not much larger than Monmouth's compact torso, was the device, the single most important element in the late Koros III's mission. All Monmouth and Orfu knew about the device was that the Ganymedan was supposed to deliver it to Olympus Mons and, under proper circumstances not shared with Monmouth or Orfu, activated. Monmouth probed the device with sonar and removed a tiny part of its reflective transalloy shell. Its function was not revealed. The actual machine, if machine it was macromolecular. Essentially, a single nano-squared machined molecule with a chewy central core of tremendous energy, contained only by the macromolecule's internal fields. The only device that Monmouth could find associated with the shell was a current-generated zipper initiator. 32 volts applied to just the right place on the shell would do something to the macromolecule inside.
It could be a bomb, said Monmouth, as he carefully replaced the square centimeter of metal shell.
Quite a bomb, muttered Orfu. If the M molecule is mostly a binding eggshell, we're talking a planet buster here. The yolk would be on us.
Pretending he hadn't heard the pun in order to preserve their friendship and to keep from having to throw Orfu over the railing, Monmouth had looked out at the passing canyon walls. They were still sailing within 3 kilometers of the high southern cliffs bordering the broad inland sea that day. And imagined all that red-rocked, terraced, and striated beauty gone. He thought of the periscoping mangroves that grew in the marsh and lower estuary marshlands. The natural topiary gorse visible on the valley cliff's higher walls. Even the fragile blue sky with ripples of high cirrus above the rock. And tried to imagine it all destroyed by one quantum explosion huge enough to rip a world apart. It hardly seemed right. Couldn't you think of anything else it could be other than a bomb? He asked Orfu.
Not offhand, said the Ionian. But something containing that much pent-up implosive quantum energy represents technology way beyond my understanding. I'd suggest you treat the device gently. Put some cushions under it or something. But since it's already survived the chariot people's attack and atmospheric entry that fried me and killed your ship, it can't be too delicate. Give it a kick in the ass and move on. What's the next piece of cargo?
The next piece of cargo was just a bit larger than the device, but much more understandable. It's some sort of squirt communicator, said Monmouth. It's all folded in on itself, but I can see that if I activate it, it'll unfurl onto its own tripod, aim a large dish toward the sky and fire a serious burst of something. Encoded energy in tight band or K-maser, or perhaps even modulated gravity.
Why would Koros have needed that? Asked Orfu. The commsats are still in orbit and the spaceship could have relayed any sort of tight beam or radio back to Galilean space. Hell, even your sub could have contacted home.
Maybe this wasn't meant to broadcast to Jupiter space, suggested Monmouth.
Where then?
Monmouth had no suggestions.
How was Koros going to code the message? Asked the Ionian.
There are virtual jackports, said Monmouth after inspecting the compact machinery carefully under its nanocarbon skin. We could download everything we've seen and learned, encrypt it, and activate it, unless it needs an activation code or something. Want me to jack in and check?
No, said Orfu, not yet.
I'll close it then.
What does this communicator use for a squirt power source? Asked Orfu, before Monmouth could close up the device.
Monmouth wasn't familiar with the technology, but he described the magnetic container and force field schematics.
My, said Orfu, that's Chevkovian Felsenmas. Artificial antimatter of the kind the consortium used to fuel the first interstellar probe. There's enough energy there to keep us alive and kicking for another several Earth centuries, if there were a way for us to tap into it.
Monmouth had felt his organic heart skip a beat. Could we have used it to replace the fusion reactor on the lady?
Orfu was quiet for several long seconds. No, I don't think so, he said at last. Too much energy released too fast and too hard to tame. It's possible that you and I could tap into its trickle field, but I don't think we could have powered up the Dark Lady with it even if the sub could have been repaired. And you said you couldn't do the repairs alone, right?
It would have taken the Connemara Chaos Ice Docks, said Monmouth, feeling a strange combination of regret and relief at the news that this wasn't a fix for the poor lady. As much as the death of his ship depressed him, the thought of turning back and sailing the 2,000-plus kilometers back to it was even more depressing. The last piece of cargo was the largest, the heaviest, and the hardest for Monmouth to figure out. The container was a bamboo 3-cube, 1.5 meters tall by 2 meters wide, wrapped in clear transpolymer. A brief inspection showed Monmouth that the cube was filled with hundreds of square meters of micro-thin polyethylene stealth composite with high-performance solar cell strips embedded in the fabric, 24 interconnected, partially nested articulated conical titanium segments, 4 pressurized canisters containing what his sensors said was helium, an oxygen-nitrogen mix, and methanol, 8 atmospheric pulse thrusters with jack-in controllers, and finally, 12 15-meter folded bucky carbon cables attached to the four sides of the bamboo three box the thing came in. I give up, said Monroe, after several minutes of pondering and poking and refolding. What the hell is it?
A balloon, said Orfu.
Monmouth shook his Moravec head. There were both living and Moravec balloon creatures in the atmosphere of Jupiter, more swimming in the soup of Saturn, but what would Koros III have wanted with an artificial balloon on Mars? Orfu transmitted the answer even as Monmouth heard it in his own mind.
Koros's mission was to get to the top of Olympus Mons, to the locus of the quantum disturbance, and this way he wouldn't have to climb the volcano. What are the dimensions of this balloon?
Monmouth told the Ionian.
Inflated with helium here at null-null, Martian sea level, that would give a diameter of just over 60 meters and a height of about 35 meters, which should easily lift the gondola, you, the device, and the squirt radio to the fringes of space. Or to the top of Olympus, said Orfu.
Gondola? Said Monmouth, still trying to absorb this concept.
The box it came in. That's obviously what Koros III planned to ride in. Does it have a transpolymer hood? Some sort of pressurizable cover?
Yes.
There you have it.
But Olympus Mons has an escalator going up its south side, Monmouth said stupidly.
Koros and the Moravex who planned this mission didn't know that, said Orfu.
Monmouth looked away from the balloon for a minute to think. The southern cliffs of Valles Marineris were just a thin red line against the blue-green horizon as the Palooka moved deeper into the center channels of the estuarial river. The gondola is too small to carry you, he said.
Well, naturally, began Orfu.
I'll build a bigger gondola, interrupted Monmouth.
Do you really think we'll be ascending to the summit of Olympus Mons? Orfu said softly.
I don't know, said Monmouth. But I do know that we'll still be more than 2,000 kilometers from the volcano when, if we ever reach the western end of Valles Marineris in this little ship. I didn't have any idea how we were going to get through the jumble of Noctis Labyrinthus and over the Tharsis Plateau to Olympus, but this balloon might work, maybe.
We could start now, said Orfu. It would be faster than this, what did you call it?
Palooka, said Monmouth, glancing up at the rigging and sails sharp against the pink and blue sky. Several of the little green men were swinging effortlessly from line to line in the rigging. And no, I don't think we should try the balloon until we have to. It uses chameleon stealth fabric, even on the gondola. But I'm not convinced that the flying chariot people couldn't track it. We'll launch it when we reach Noctis Labyrinthus. That'll be a long and difficult enough aerial journey as it is, since three of the tallest volcanoes on Mars will be between us and Olympus. Orfu rumbled close to the subsonic.
Around the world in 80 days, eh?
Not around the world, said Monmouth. Counting this boat trip, we have to travel just a little more than one-fourth the way around it. Monmouth tried to pass the time and shake himself out of his low mood by reading Shakespeare's sonnets from the physical book he'd salvaged from the Dark Lady. It didn't work, whereas during the past few years he'd disappeared into analysis, ferreting out hidden structures, word connections, and dramatic content. The sonnets seemed like sad things now, sad and rather nasty. End of side 9.